You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 26, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Benjamin T. Smith, professor of Latin American history at the University of Warwick, author of The Dope, The Real History of the Mexican Drug Trade. Also on the program today, surprise, budget negotiations continue. Democrats try to include some immigration reform. Meanwhile, as the White House rejiggers climate provisions to appease President Manchin, paid family and medical leave gets cut to 4 weeks. Virginia governor race is 1 week away. It's in a dead heat, ladies and gentlemen. Meanwhile, in Chicago, they're on the verge of the nation's largest basic income program. The U.S. freezes Sudanese aid in the wake of a coup there. Amazon workers in Staten Island file for union elections. And the New York City cop union sues over New York's vaccine mandate. U.S. issues new travel rules into the U.S., eases up on countries that have low accessibility to vaccines, and COP26 starts in a week with breakthroughs on climate proposals unlikely. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Apologies for my partial absence yesterday. But of course, Emma Vigeland was here to hold down the fort. Emma, thank you. And of course, you're here today, or I wouldn't be able to thank you.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for acknowledging my thank you.
Thank you.
The Manners Report.
What's that?
The Manners Report.
Exactly.
Ah, good day to you, Matthew.
Hello.
Hello.
That's, I kind of like, I was just,
British.
I was using intimate manners. Romney.
Yeah. Right. Before we get to any of this, a couple of points of notice and house cleaning for this program. Housekeeping, house cleaning. So a little house cleaning and some keeping. First off, we should tell you that this show is no longer streamed on the Peacock Network. Our contract has ended. It was a year. And so things are going to get a little bit more loosey-goosey, like the old days.
Like shit?
No. You cannot. No, that wasn't a function of Peacock.
Oh.
We didn't. I don't approve of that type of life.
Okay.
No. That's not what I was saying.
I'm so sorry.
That is not appropriate. No, what I'm talking about is we're not going to hit 55 minutes every time now. That's one of the big changes. We may go back to the, I don't know if you remember, but back in the day we would do like, hey, we're only doing a 20-minute free show today. If you want more, you got to get the fun half.
Keep people on their toes.
Sometimes I may go 60 minutes with a guest if I'm feeling it. I'm not going to cut them off in 55 minutes. That ain't happening anymore. Other things? No more exclusively solid shirts. I'm probably going to bring back a couple plaids. Maybe a striped shirt occasionally. Although most of those have like worn out and I didn't replace them. So don't freak out if you see me wearing like a plaid shirt like the old days. I don't know if people noticed, but my wardrobe significantly changed over the past year where it was just solids.
Right. Because of the moraying.
because of the moraine that we would have when we were on the tube. Now, I may still hold back on going, you know, too many plaids, but I don't want to freak anybody out.
More tank tops?
That won't happen. But people now I know people are going to talk, and they're going to see these changes, and they're going to realize how we were under the thumb of this corporate behemoth.
Mm-hmm.
They like things like, ooh, interesting. Sam never wore a plaid shirt before. While he was they were streaming on Peacock.
We might start criticizing Democrats.
That may happen. We may end up maybe going in on Manchin. No more holding back on that. And we could possibly bring on the executive director of the WGA again. But I don't know. That would have been three times.
Right.
We had him on Peacock. So we had him on Peacock twice. But I just want to let people know and tell you, you know, there was, of course, now I can't go into the details of the contract that we had with Peacock. But I can tell you this. I've had to cut back on my private jet travel. Mm-hmm. Significantly.
I can't take a helicopter to work anymore.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
The jet, the helicopter, the jet, the amphibious boat truck thing I had.
Right.
I canceled my lease. But no, this is a good opportunity to remind folks that it is our members who support this program. And when you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you keep the free show surviving and thriving, and then you also get the member show, which has extra content virtually every day. So it is your support that has. We've now gone from like, for a while, our members were supporting the show 92.3%. Back in the old days, it was like or closer to like 99.4%, according to the CFO. And now we're back up to 98.6%.
It's also good body heat.
That's where I made it up. That I realized as soon as that came out of my mouth, I was making that up from just like temperature that people.
Yeah,
take.
Right.
No, I've never been able to calculate. I wouldn't have. There's no in a million years. We don't have any type of books that show percentages or anything like that. But
yeah.
So your support keeps this show alive. Also, if you want to sign up for the AM Quickie newsletter, well, then just go to amquickie.com and sign up for the newsletter. People are loving it. We're not quite sure where we're going to go with it. The AM Quickie, one of the things about the Peacock shows were that they were helpful in terms of supporting things like AM Quickie, which we have yet to figure out how to monetize. But we're going to be working on that. So we're not exactly sure, but sign up for it. Check it out and enjoy. And also, reminder, tickets are now on sale for Majority Report Live.
Yes.
It is. The show is at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. It is Sunday, January 16th at 3 p.m. We're going to have guests and...
And if you're in the mood for like a tropical vacation in January, too bad. You still should come to Boston.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me. I mean, I grew up in Worcester, and you know, Worcester is a snow belt. January, I mean, Boston.
I mean, you grew up in North Dakota.
January is going
to
be...
I'm going to dig it. I liked... I used to go to Chicago. I went to Chicago twice in a row for January 1st, and it was just freezing both times, but you basically had the city to yourself. I'm a big fan of very cold times in the major metropolitan
areas. You've said that to me before.
It doesn't get that cold there.
No, I understand. Yes, but my point is just... it'll be fun.
All right, so all that said and done, you're going to notice some dramatic changes around here. We're no longer going to, you know, pussyfoot around when it comes to people like Claire McCaskill, who we've been promoting so vociferously. So you're going to see some real change. We're going to be completely unleashed now.
Yeah. Sam Unchained.
I do think that there is a good chance that I'm probably going to knock down my shaving one time a week.
Oh, wow.
And that's probably going to happen. So
is that helpful for Harry's?
I mean, when I shave, it'll still be Harry's. It's just that I won't be shaving as much.
Yeah. And we'll and it'll provide such relief for everyone who's been looking at you throughout this time that they'll be like, wow, Harry's must work a lot because that guy looks so much better.
Right. Right. I'm not sure. I've totally fallen. And also, this thing, this button, probably there'll be times where that would...
Whoa.
I'm joking. All right.
It's going to be an indoor pool. Sam's going to
so, here, let's talk about the reconciliation bill goes on. It's going to be, we're going to be disappointed. Very disappointed. There's just no doubt in my mind. And I don't know how else to put that. And it's you know, we're going to have to deal with it. But in the meantime, one of the things that's getting floated, in part because Kristen Sinema does not want an increase in corporate taxes.
Or the top marginal rate.
Or the top marginal rate. Is apparently she is open to a billionaire's tax. We do not know exactly how this is framed, whether it's a wealth tax or if there's some type of like big donut hole, or we just don't know. Ron Wyden's been working on it in the Senate for 2 years, but nobody's seen any documents about it. It has been one of those things that's been sitting on the shelf, or at least been being worked on a shelf.
Ron Wyden's been in the lab with a pen and a pen and on that billionaire tax.
But broadly speaking, the idea of billionaires paying more money, frankly, I would like a wealth tax. I would like to go in and take their wealth. Not because we need it to fund things, but because we have a real problem. Not just with wealth inequality in this country, but the political inequality that wealth inequality gives birth to. We have gone from a plutonomy to a plutocracy. And who better to critique the idea of billionaires getting taxed more than a 100 millionaire himself, Mitt Romney?
Oh, there he goes.
Well, first of all, it's not a good idea to tell billionaires, don't come to America, don't start your business here, to tell the Steve Jobs and the Bill Gates and people like that, this isn't the place to begin your business, go somewhere else. That's a bad idea. But number two, you're going to tax people not when they sell something, but just when they own it and the value goes up. And what that means is that people are, these multi-billionaires, are going to look and say, I don't want to invest in the stock market because as that goes up, I'm going to get taxed. So maybe I will instead invest in a ranch or in paintings or things that don't build jobs and create a stronger economy. That kind of-
Okay, two things. Let's work backwards to front. Investing in making money in the stock market, that does not create jobs. That does not create jobs. There is no, there may be a loose sort of trajectory correlation between, how the stock market's doing and the number of jobs that are added. But that is super, super loose and in no way is causal.
Maybe some more sweaty stock traders on the floor of the.
maybe a dozen people get more jobs.
But
maybe there's more.
Like the top line number.
ranches and paintings. I mean, like, you know, for Mitt Romney, who has several hundred million dollars, I'm not exactly sure how much his wealth is. He, as sort of plebe as he is relative to a billionaire, must understand the concept that, like, they can afford the taxes. It's not going to change their spending behavior whatsoever. And Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, I want to remind Mitt Romney, were not billionaires when they started their company. But yes, if you are a billionaire, I would be in favor of you should not come to America. In fact, I would be in favor of you should not only not come to America, you should not have American citizenship. And you're not allowed to lobby or even own companies that are allowed to lobby in this country. Can we do that? Is Romney suggesting we can do that? Because if we can, I'll... I will sign up.
I'll sign up for that.
Know how Joseph Kennedy sort of like his whole story in the New Deal was, or I guess in, after the Great Depression was he was the inside man helping to show where the bodies are buried on Wall Street, and that's how he could help it. Well, Romney could play that role, but instead he's saying it's just impossible because they're going to spend it in ranches and paintings. Well, or how about you have elevators. Some provisions about those sorts of money laundering or flight from taxes? You could tax paintings and ranches and stuff like that if you wanted to.
Yeah, there are ways in which to do this, and I think I'm not exactly sure what provision of the billionaire's tax he's talking about. We don't know that one. I mean, he must like have
I don't think we know the, like, again, Wyden's working on it. We don't know the exact language. We know it's going to raise a lot less than increasing corporate taxes and the top marginal rate would.
I'm less concerned about raising the money, and I am more in favor of inhibiting people owning and monopolizing money.
Yeah, leveling, basically.
Exactly.
That's fine. I do think that this is less structural, and that's why someone like Sinema is in favor of it, and I think that that's obvious.
To me, it's more structural. It is basically saying we're not going to allow, and we need to see how it, but we're not going to allow billionaires or multi-billionaires. I mean, I would like to basically, any money that you have over, let's say, let's just ease people into this. Any money you have over $900 million, and I know that's a shock to a lot of people, you get taken away. It gets taken away. That's, you're not allowed to, like, you get up to $800 million, $900 million, then I think, like, you're done. You're done.
And then you might have to hire more delivery drivers and, allow some more of your deliverers to take bathroom breaks if you're Jeff Bezos, for instance.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Now, I think what he's talking about is a mark-to-market assessment of like the capital that you own, and that gets taxed. I don't know if that would happen on a yearly basis, but we have a model for that, and it is called real estate taxes. It exists. You get taxed on the value of your home as assessed by a local tax assessor, and so we can do this. We'll get to the other Mitt Romney thing later, but I'm all in favor of billionaire tax. I'm all in favor of a tax that eliminates billionaires.
I'm all in favor of billionaire taxes as a supplement, is all I'm saying.
Well, I say ban them from entering the country, too.
In fact, deport them.
Deport the billionaires.
We are a pro-deportation of billionaires show here.
And, or you can just, like, shed yourself of the billions, and then... I actually, at least right now, am more in favor, I think, of confiscatory taxing of billionaires. I don't know if this would be that, than even the raising of corporate taxes. The individual income tax I would like to see higher as well. But, all right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Benjamin Smith, professor of Latin American history at the University of Warwick, author of The Dope, The Real History of the Mexican Drug Trade. First, I just want to remind you that Danny, who is my solar nerd, he can be your solar nerd, but he is located at mysolarnerd.com. He is a solar consultant, longtime fan and listener of this program, was working with other companies that do solar. Some of them he found were a little predatory in their practices. You get involved in a lease and the structure of the lease is such that you're sort of locked in for a long period of time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He started a solar consultancy business to make sure that people didn't fall into those type of traps, and also to help people navigate the different tax benefits and find contractors to do this. There's a lot of different solar options that are currently available. Most homeowners don't have any idea what to do. You can now retrofit a home with solar panels for no money down. And most homeowners that switch over to solar see significant savings starting in their first year. And this is possible because of a tax that has been extended with COVID into next year. It is the Solar Investor Tax Credit. It is a 26% tax credit, It is extended through next year, then it drops to 22% in 2023. My Solar Nerds mission is simple. It helps you find the best solar program for your home. Make the transition as easy and smooth as possible. How do they do it? They analyze your usage. They find the best equipment for your needs. Maybe you need these type of panels. Maybe for hot water, heat, whatever it is. They determine the incentives and financing that you might qualify for. They project manage the whole process between you and the installers. They obtain the permits, et cetera, et cetera. Now, look, some of those tax credits and incentives are going to sunset at one point. 26% tax credit will drop down to 22% in 2003. And then there are some markets, which, of course, you will know this, are prone to power outages. You may qualify for off-the-grid backup solutions. Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. Go to mysolarnerd.com, fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select Majority Report listener for how you heard about mysolarnerd.com to receive that $200 gift card upon installation. And also, just to let Danny know that it's getting the word out on the show. Check it out. It is worth sussing out if you can have some savings on solar power. Good time to do it right now with that 26% tax credit floating around out there. All right. I want to welcome to the show Professor of Latin American History at the University of Warwick, author of The Dope, The Real History of the Mexican Drug Trade, Benjamin Smith. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sam.
I'm here with Emma Vigeland. So I want to just start with, I mean, I think sort of the title begs for this question. The real history of the Mexican drug trade. What's the fake history? What's the myth that we have been led to believe all these years?
Well, I think really for 100 years, both the drug authorities, the kind of nowadays the DEA and the US authorities and the Mexican authorities have essentially portrayed the drug war as a kind of pretty easy moral binary. On the one hand, you've got good cops who are trying to save your children from addiction. And on the other hand, you have a kind of evil cabal of mostly brown Mexican cartel members who are trying to addict your children. So this is a kind of easy moral binary into which our stories of the drug trade and the war on drugs fit pretty easily. And you can see them in popular films today or in Netflix series or any of these kind of cultural forms.
Is this myth a north of the border myth, or is this myth like one that initiated in the U.S. and then sort of did its own migration to Mexico? I mean, where, like, when we say this myth exists, and it exists for the past 100 years, let's say, and, you know, sort of conveniently around the time where we started to limit immigration in this country, is the myth shared in Mexico? Like, what, or to the extent that it is now, when did that happen?
That's a very good question. So, essentially, when there was a massive expansion of the drug trade during the 1960s and 1970s, basically when the counterculture, the hippies, started to get high and started to import vast quantities of weed and then by the late 1970s, heroin into the United States. At that point, the American kind of mythology over the evil drug trafficker was effectively imported into Mexico. I suppose what's interesting about Mexico is still to this day, there is a kind of folk heroization of the drug trafficker, which is a kind of counterpoint to this kind of evil mythology, this easy moral binary. So people like Chapo, for many people in Sinaloa, is a hero, even though he is, you know, derided as a kind of evil figure in the United States and in official media in Mexico as well.
I want to circle back to that, but just will you tell us the extent? I mean, your reporting was pretty extensive for this. I think it's a little bit of an understatement. Will you just outline for us sort of like, you know, what you looked at as you were writing this book? And we should say this is, you know, ultimately a history of the development of those myths in many respects. But what exactly did you do in terms of the reporting for this book?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm a historian, as you can tell from the accent. I'm from Britain. I've been studying, I'm a kind of doctor in history at a place called Warwick, but I've been studying Mexico for 20 odd years. And really, since the beginning of this particularly aggressive version of the war on drugs that's led to around 200,000 people dead over the last 15 years. And really, for the last decade, I've been looking at the history of the trade and the history of the war against that trade. So this has involved going to about 40 or 50 archives. It's involved tracking down DEA agents. It's involved tracking down old hippie weed smugglers. And it's involved speaking to dozens of people involved in pretty much every echelon of the drug trade now and over the last 20 or 30 years. So, yeah, it's been a, I'm not going to say a labor of love, but it's been a pretty long-term project, which has led to this book.
Let's start with, as we you know, and if there are figures that you feel like, you know, you obviously want to introduce, but there's a couple that stood out for me. Just starting with 1908, where you basically start your book with the King of the Stoners. Tell us about him and how, where, what was the trade at that point?
So I think there's a kind of assumption that Mexico has always had a kind of fairly strong subculture or even culture of marijuana smoking, but in actual fact, it was pretty rare. And it, still to this day, far fewer Mexicans smoke marijuana than the percentages in the US or so. Starting in the 20th century, the early 20th century, however, there was a small growing industry in smoking marijuana, mostly among prisoners and soldiers, like in the barracks, where they basically were prevented from bringing in booze, so they smoked weed instead. And the so-called King of the Stoners, a guy called José del Moral, was really the first kind of major wholesaler of marijuana. He brought it in from the countryside, probably the state of Guanajuato, brought it into Mexico City, and then sold it to the kind of folk healers who would flog it on as a kind of medicine, and also flogging it into the prisons itself. I mean, what is interesting is that he gets put in prison. He gets one of the first kind of convictions of Mexico's own war on drugs. And he writes this incredibly eloquent defense of marijuana as a kind of medicinal product, which seems remarkably modern for 1908. So yeah, I kind of start with this figure who I suppose shows the kind of, yeah, you know, the kind of paradoxes at the heart of this kind of war on drugs, that so many people who flog the drugs or take the drugs don't see them necessarily as deeply harmful, but rather as basically medicinal products.
And how did that fit into the United States's rebranding of, say, cannabis into the much scarier marijuana? Because, like, one of the great through lines of your book is how these myths perpetuate U.S. nativism as it relates to Mexico. And that seems to be one of the starting points of that dynamic.
I mean, this is fascinating. I'm not going to claim to have discovered this. There's a wonderful historian called Isaac Campos who did this kind of 5-10 years ago. But essentially, it is Mexico that comes up with the idea of reefer madness. Mexican elites who are worried about their prisoners and their soldiers smoking weed, and they believe that smoking weed leads to really serious acts of violence, basically to murder. Now, the Americans don't have a problem with weed smoking, really don't have a problem with weed smoking until the 1960s. But in the 1930s, a man called Harry Anslinger, who was head of effectively the pre-DEA, something called the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, he's basically about to lose his job. He finds himself without a kind of war to fight. So he imports these Mexican fears over marijuana and makes them and basically implants them in the white middle class in the United States. So that's where your reefer madness comes from. That's where your paranoid fear of weed smoking Mexicans come from. It's actually imported from Mexican elites that came up with this in the early 1900s.
And why did that? What was the theory of them coming up with it? I mean, was there any type of like farming that was going on at that time? I mean, what, like, was this just grown like people would grow, I don't know, basil in their backyard or something like that? I mean, how much of a production was there to the extent that there was? I mean, was this a commercial, was this a commodity at that time? Or at what point within Mexico does it become a commodity?
So during the early kind of 20th century, there is an expansion of marijuana use, basically because there are more soldiers under arms, because Mexico has this big revolution from 1910 to 1920, and lots more people are basically soldiers stuck in barracks. So no doubt the amount of marijuana smoke by Mexicans does increase, but it never gets out of hand. And it never really percolates up into the United States. So I would say outside Mexico City, which is the biggest city at the time, there are about 10 or 12 villages that are devoted to selling, to growing really, really small crops of marijuana, certainly not an acre worth in each village. So really small amounts. Where it really takes off, and it's tantamount almost to an oil boom, is the late 1960s. So effectively when America start smoking weed, and hundreds of thousands of hippies and student holiday makers come down to Mexico and basically start asking for marijuana. And this creates a huge boom in marijuana growing throughout Mexico. And there you get pretty much every state up in the mountains is growing weed for the US market. So that's the radical growth, kind of 65 through to 70.
All right. Before we get to that era, let's talk about the 1940 experiment that then Mexican President Cardenas legalized pot for 4 months. Why did he initiate that experiment, and why did it last so? Why was it so short?
Well, this is kind of depressing, but at the same time, quite redolent story of relations between Mexico and the US and drugs. So essentially, there's this brilliant Mexican doctor who comes up with the idea of legalizing pot. Now, they don't quite manage to push that through, although the government seems to support him. But his other idea is to completely decriminalize morphine. And instead of the drug traffickers making loads of money by selling heroin and morphine to these poor addicts, instead, the government would give away heroin and morphine for free or for a very, very low price at state morphine clinics. So the idea being that this would basically get rid of drug traffickers and drug dealers. And instead, the state could treat these addicts and help them recover. Now, it seemed to me this is a fairly good idea, and one that has been repeated now in certain other places around the world. However, again, Harry Anslinger, the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, thinks it's a spectacularly bad idea. And as a result, he cuts off Mexico from importing any morphine. Now, this means that the Mexican addicts can't get any morphine through this government program, but it also means that thousands of Mexicans die in abject pain in their hospital beds without any pain relief. This doesn't matter, however, it basically forces the Mexicans to stop their experiment. And as a result, he starts allowing morphine going back into the country halfway through 1940. So it's a short-lived experiment, one that perhaps kind of indicates a possible better future. But one that unfortunately, never really took off.
Let's talk about this dynamic as we get into the 60s, and it becomes a much bigger commodity, and we start to see, although this dynamic on some level predates, you know, how big of a commodity it becomes in the 60s. When you talk about the violence, I mean, this is one of the things that I think, you know, ran through the book, was that the violence is not a function of the drugs. It is a function of the black market nature of the drugs. And there were two elements. One is sort of walk us through how that works, because, and also start with, I guess, the dynamic of how Mexican officials, and before we get into the 60s and 70s, we're talking about really on the state level. They weren't exactly corrupt. Some people were, but they were using, there was basically a black market tax. Explain that dynamic.
It's a really good way to put it, Sam, a black market tax. So effectively, I think part of the whole kind of drug war mythology is that Mexican officials have basically taken drug money to look the other way, that Mexican officials are effectively corrupt and they built gargantuan houses or bought luxurious yachts with this money. But one thing I think, and I think to a certain extent, I, like many others, had a very similar vision. But one thing I was really surprised to find was quite how much of that effectively at the local level, local mayors, local governors, local cops would effectively charge drug traffickers a certain percentage of their profits not to prosecute them. But they would then use this money actually to build up the state. So they would build railways and roads and schools with this money. Yes, some of them would pocket it, but a lot of them didn't. And one thing that I think really, really shocked me was finding documents where the US investigated this and the US was shocked. The US found that the state cops would shake down, would basically extort these drug traffickers in return for protection. But they would take the money and they would give it straight to the state tax collector. So this is kind of how it works. So I call these, I think corruption is not a terribly useful word because it's a kind of loaded moral term. We always think of corruption as bad. So I just called it, it's basically a protection racket. It's basically the state, the local cops and the local governors were protecting the drug traffickers in return for, as you rightly say, a black market tax.
Who are they? And I imagine the shock was from the United States was more like, wait, and you're putting this into the commons, essentially? but who were they protecting them from? I mean, they were protecting them from the state ultimately too, right? It's basically just, so if there was this notion of like the state officials are like, look, if this was legal, you'd be paying us a tax. So we're going to sort of decriminalize it, for a tax. Because that's what it is, right? I mean, it's a tax in the sense that it's going into the tax coffers. Why was there not the ability on a political level just to sort of formalize that relationship and make it not so, like black markety?
So effectively, so you ask it, I mean, that you started that initially with, okay, if the authorities are protecting him, who are they protecting him against? So effectively, they were protecting them against two groups. One is the United States, which particularly during the 1950s become increasingly, gets increasingly involved in other countries and particularly Mexico's drug policy. And then actual forces Mexico to put in place some really punitive laws. So state governors go, we won't put you in jail for 15 years, right? Because that is what the Americans want the Mexicans to do. The other group is there are people in the federal administration. Mexico, like the United States, is a federation, right, with states. But there are people at the kind of level of the cabinet or the level of the president or the level of the head federal police who do want to put these drug traffickers in prison. So these local authorities basically protect the drug traffickers against those two groups.
Okay, fair enough. And then as we go into the 60s and 70s, I guess it is. The other thing, let me just stay on this. On the other thing that's causing this violence is the war on drugs and the sort of cartel wars, which in many respects was a function of the DEA. Is that right? Explain that dynamic.
Yeah, so I think I, like many other people, had assumed that the leaders of these cartels were naturally kind of selfish capitalists who attempted to kind of monopolize the traffic of drugs throughout Mexico. So you would have the Sinaloa cartel that would fight the Gulf cartel for control of trafficking through a particular area. But one thing that I found looking at the history of the trade is that basically most of the time drug traffickers cooperate. Basically because drug trafficking necessitates basically networks of people that will traffic the drugs through particular routes. Now, what I found out in the over the last kind of 20 years or so, which seems upshoot in what looks like cartel violence, it is often either the DEA or the federal Mexican authorities that are managing to basically divide the cartels against one another, principally by catching somebody like Chapo and forcing Chapo to rat out another part of his group, another wing of his cartel. So they would effectively create these breaks in cartels by using informants and then wedge open these divisions. In actual fact, the DEA had a term for it. They called it divide and conquer. So what looks like these cartels at each other's throats over the drug trade is often them fighting the DEA's own wars for them. I think this was the most shocking, really.
I mean, that to me is just sort of fascinating insofar as like that is a strategy where they get them fighting amongst each other, because there's no evidence that in any way weakens the industry, does it? I mean, it sort of feels like what is the value of that ultimately? Well, I mean, I guess this is sort of point of the book too, on some of us.
It's a really good question. But basically, the point of it is the DEA can go and give a PowerPoint presentation to other people in Washington saying, look, classically between 2012 and 2018, Mexico arrested 130, were arrested or killed, or were killed 130 out of 140 so-called kingpins. And the DEA's budget increased commensurately during those 6 years. Added the budget of the federal police in Mexico, added the budget of the army as well in Mexico. What did this actually do to drug addiction? Absolutely nothing. In actual fact, the price of coke and heroin went down during that period, and the amount of people overdosing on US streets went up during that period. So the DEA has never really had any real interest in overdoses or the ease of getting drugs in America. What it is very good at is selling its war as a victory, and showing these kind of dead capos and Chapo in jail was good publicity.
Well, then it doesn't make it necessarily functionally different than any one of the wars that the United States is waging throughout other areas of the globe. You can just see this as an extension of U.S. empire, except you can make drugs the amorphous enemy as budgets go up and people get to feel like they're warriors for the good empire, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's got a lot of parallels with the kind of war on terrorism, this kind of amorphous enemy that you can never really conquer, that you continually name, right? You continually have these dreadful terrorists that are, manipulating everything, that are pulling all the puppet strings. Then you get rid of them. Then you sell that as a success, but you still have to wage the war on terrorism. So you still need the budget to be increased. And it's very similar with the war on drugs.
Let's talk about the back in the 60s,
it's getting dark here. I'm going to put the light on, if that's all right.
Oh,
that's yes. And maybe you could just tilt your camera just a little bit, maybe just angle it so that the light's not behind you directly.
Yes, okay, that's better. Is that better?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's okay. Great. In the 60s, the drug business gets professionalized by a guy named Pedro Aviles Perez. Mm-hmm. That is presumed, or at least I guess the legend was that he was El Chapo's godfather. But that was not, I don't know if that was really apocryphal or what, but how did they professionalize? Like at that point, like what does that mean to professionalize it?
Yeah, so effectively, rather than the traffickers being really kind of small-scale operators that would essentially have a network of kind of maybe 5-10 mostly family members that actually knew the people who were growing the opium poppies, often either were or knew the chemists personally. They were family members who were making that opium into heroin, and then knew the people who had a kind of stash house on the border. Maybe another family member who would actually traffic the stuff across. Now, what this man, Pedro Aviles Perez, does is he does two things. Essentially, one, he brings together marijuana and heroin trafficking that up to that point would be completely separate. And he creates this huge network of border warehouses where he stores weed and heroin from all over Mexico. So if you're a trafficker down in southern Mexico, you come out to his warehouses, sell to him, and he smuggles the stuff over the border. And he has a fleet of aeroplanes. So I suppose he is the modern version of what becomes known as a kingpin. So he is, I think, pretty responsible for this kind of modernization of the trade. And you're right, he is. There are certain myths that he was the godfather of Chapo. He knew Chapo. I don't think necessarily that's true. I think Chapo did have relatives involved in the trade, but the principal one being a guy called Silvino Guzman. But I don't think Pedro Aviles was very close to him.
And it was around that time, maybe a little bit later, that that dynamic with state police and state institutions being sort of like collecting these black market tax sort of moves, it becomes federal at that point, that the Mexican federal government essentially starts to maintain that same dynamic with drug dealers. Give us a sense of, like, when we talk about this drug trade, what, and I imagine it's shifted, well, and I know it's shifted over the years, but what are we talking about in terms of, like, pot versus heroin versus cocaine? I mean, what is the dynamic there? Is it just simply when the U.S. cracks down on heroin, coke sales go up? When the U.S. cracks down on pot, heroin goes up. Is that basically how it works?
Pretty much. I kind of tell you, it's the kind of emergency supplier for the United States. So when basically drugs are not easily available from another place, Mexico will provide for them. So there are times when you're right, marijuana isn't selling terribly well from Mexico because there's better quality stuff from Jamaica or Colombia during the late 1970s. But then as soon as that supply is closed down, Mexico steps in. Again, Mexican heroin is not thought of as terribly good during the 1970s. So they get most of the stuff from either Thailand or from Turkey via France. But when those are closed down, again, Mexico steps in with kind of Mexican mud or kind of brown Mexican heroin. So it's a kind of emergency supply. And so it's always produced weed. It's always produced heroin and morphine. And it's always been a key transshipment point for cocaine. Late 90s, it was trafficking somewhere in the region of 95% of America's cocaine. And America was taking about 70% of the world's cocaine. So there was a lot of coke.
We were really number one. That was not.
Yeah. You've lost out now to Brazil and Western Europe. So, you know, I think that as a victory.
We may get back there. Lastly, I want to compare Nieto to the current president, López Obrador. Tell us about that dynamic. Mm-hmm. and how that has shifted, and how Obrador seemed to come in with one agenda but is exercising another. Let's go through that and before we get to, you know, where this is going to lead to the extent that we know.
Okay, so effectively, AMLO, López Obrador, comes to power with a slogan, which is hugs, not bullets. So the idea being that we are not going to viciously, violently police the drug trade, but instead we're going to offer social and economic opportunities to the kind of young men who get pulled into this kind of violent crime. So on the surface, I think instinctively, he has some quite interesting instincts. And I think at least initially, his attempt was to do effectively two things. One, not pursue the policy of basically allowing the DEA to come down and divide and conquer cartels. So basically not taking out kingpins, which they've been doing for about a decade. So I think that was quite good. And he has effectively stopped, right? There have been no kingpins that have been arrested over the last 3 years. In actual fact, 2 years ago, they did arrest Chapo's son. And Chapo's son threatened to basically blow up the city where he had been caught, or certainly kill the families of the people who caught him. And the president stepped down. He let him go. So Chapo's son still lives relatively openly in northern Mexico. So on the one hand, he's doing that. He's also attempted to offer more social and economic opportunities for the young, particularly of borderlands Mexico. This has been, two major problems. One, COVID, and two, a not terribly successful economy over the last 3 years, then made worse by COVID. So this isn't working. But I think the most confusing thing about AMLO is that having said originally that he would put the military back in the barracks, again, that was one of his slogans. In actual fact, he seems now even more closely allied to the military, really, than any other president since perhaps the 1970s. He's not only very close to the kind of military generals. They've been given control of customs, control of border crossings, control of a lot of the kind of things that had previously been done by the bureaucracy. And at the same time, he's come up with this, 150,000 strong National Guard, which is, again, under the control of the military. So what is quite worrying, I think.
What is driving that? I mean, is that pressure from the United States? Our relaxation of drug laws in this country, to the extent that we have, I mean, you know, marijuana is largely legal through many parts of the country and decriminalized, and, you know, like they're just not the same level of marijuana prohibition in this country that there was even like 2 years ago. Has that had an impact? Why is AMLO so aggressively sort of like building this military? What's that about?
Right. So first question about marijuana. The effects that marijuana decriminalization, legalization in America had in Mexico were really counterproductive and incredibly depressing. Effectively, Mexican cartels did two things. One, they got involved in producing meth, heroin, and over the last 2 years, something called fentanyl, which is about 50 times stronger than heroin, which is killing, about 100,000 Americans per year. The second thing they got involved in is other forms of organized crime. So now you go to rural areas of Mexico, where previously peasants had grown weed. They hadn't been paid very much for it, but they'd been paid much better than they got paid for, you know, normal crops. And they could keep the cartels at kind of arm's length. Nowadays, the cartels are coming into their village. They're kidnapping them. They're extorting them. They're extorting little mum and pup kind of shops. They're extorting avocado growers and lime growers. Basically, organized crime has moved into much more socially destructive forms of violence, basically. So that's what marijuana has done, not necessarily marijuana legalization has done, not necessarily improved things, sadly. The second thing you ask is, why has he got so involved in the military, or why has he kind of militarized Mexico? Well, partially, I think he doesn't trust the federal police. He thinks the federal police were institutionally corrupt, that they worked for the previous administrations, which were not from his party. So instead, he sees the military as relatively more honest than the police, but also not tainted by strong connections to previous administrations. He sees them as a much more neutral force than necessarily the police. So I think that's why he is putting more stock by the military than the police. But it's a pretty dangerous game to play, in my opinion.
So if we're in a situation where theoretically the United States could legalize all drugs, theoretically anyways, and that there has been too much growth in institutional sort of like edification of these crime syndicates, just so that they will move into other more inherently violent crimes, right? I mean, kidnapping is the process of kidnapping and extorting and paying protection money is far more violent inherently than drug trafficking, which, you know, just involves, you know, we have a ledger and we have logistics and we need drivers. I mean, it's like, it's basically like, you know, distribution of bread, as it were, if it wasn't for the sort of the black market aspect of it. So is there some type of solution? Like what, like, I mean, how would you, do you just like approach these syndicates and say, look, here's a one-time payment of $10 billion, and you guys, you know, here's your retirement. This is, consider this your gold watch type of situation. But how do you deal with this if you can no longer sort of legalize your way out of it, as it were?
I think that's a really good question that I suspect AMLO is pulling his hair out over. I mean, so sadly, despite the fact his instincts were relatively good, as I say, he did basically make de facto agreements with some of these cartels. He did attempt to kind of, you know, help kind of young men out in the kind of border neighborhoods. Unfortunately, murders still went up, but it must be said over the last 3 months or so, I think murders have started to go down in Mexico, which is the first time for, I think it must be 8 years or so. So potentially he is actually doing something right. But it's a really good question. How do you stop these other socially destructive forms of crime like kidnapping, extortion and sex trafficking and human trafficking? I mean, I confess that I think I have a particularly bleak version of what is going on in Mexico that perhaps is not entirely fair. So I spend a lot of my time dealing with refugees who are running away from Mexico, coming to the United States and asking for asylum. So these are people, the vast majority, who are not involved in the drug trade. The vast majority are basically poor people forced, kicked off their land by some organized criminal who, yes, calls himself a member of a cartel. But I mean, bar smoking a bit of weed, I doubt he's ever trafficked anything. So this is what's going on in Mexico. So I think I do have a very kind of bleak vision of what's going on. There are clearly places in Mexico which are very safe, that are safer than any, you know, than most American cities. So this violence is concentrated in certain places, no doubt. But I'm not sure if I've given you a solution there or just a depressing litany of other things.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things we'd like to specialize in. Yes. Around here, depressing litany. That was we were debating as to whether we should name the show that. But Benjamin Smith, the book is Dope, The Dope, The Real History of the Mexican Drug Trade. Thanks so much for your time today. Really fascinating. Really appreciate it.
Cheers. Appreciate it.
Bye. All right, folks. That concludes the free portion of our program for today. You will notice finally yoked the corporate. What am I looking for? Yoke? How am I using yoke?
That's right. Yoke, the corporate yoke.
Yes. We no longer have to have that fake pause where we go take a pause and come back and wrap it up for the peacock people.
With that said, to our peacock audience, we say goodbye.
Yes. Forever.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
this signing
is not,
off.
This is not on Peacock today, so I guess I wasn't sure when that was going to end.
Right, it just kind of did.
It just kind of did. I knew it was around this time.
I don't even think it was on yesterday, but just to be sure, because we weren't sure.
No, I think yesterday was the first day it wasn't on.
Yeah. So I did say goodbye to the Peacock audience.
Yeah, no, I thought we were going to the 30th. But it turns out we went to the 25th or whatever. But that's all right. We gave them a little extra on that year. I think a year and 2 weeks or whatever it was.
By the way, you know that Harry Anslinger came up in that interview?
Yeah.
And he knew of a congressperson who was addicted to heroin, and he didn't go public with that person's name because of the damage it would do to the West. Do you know who that congressperson was? No. Joseph McCarthy.
Wow.
That was in the Johann Hari book.
Wow.
I thought you were going to say Dick Cheney. Wow. You know, so much, I'm quite convinced, of the sort of insanity that we talk about on this show, particularly when it comes to, like, other people in this sort of sphere that we deal with in particular, I think can be attributed to some form of substance abuse or another.
Some people, yeah.
I have my theories. Anyways, folks, maybe they come up in the fun half.
Yes.
Maybe they don't.
What a teaser.
There's only one way to find out. Become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member today. Also, AM Quickie. You can find it at amquickie.com and justcoffee.coop. Justcoffee.coop is, in fact, not just coffee. They have coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Try the Majority Report blend. And also, don't forget, folks, tickets on sale. Go to the Wilbur Theater. We always have a link in our podcast and YouTube descriptions, correct, Bradley?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. To go and purchase those tickets, get them now, because in a couple of weeks, I cannot promise you there'll be any left.
They're a hot commodity.
Super hot. Also, Nomi will not be joining us today because of weather. She couldn't fly. She's something. But check out her show, youtube.com/TheNomiKiShow. Matt!
Sorry, there's something going on with our YouTubes.
Huh. Something's up with the stream? What's going on?
I think we might be back now, hopefully. There's F's in chat, but...
We're back?
Yeah, I think we're back.
Everything looks fine, so hopefully it was just a minor interruption.
Okay.
But,
all right.
Yeah, what is happening on Left Reckoning? We're talking to Ben Burgess about his debate with Charlie Kirk, and going to talk about his upcoming book on Christopher Hitchens, who was kind of central to both David and I's intellectual development, and who now we've sort of graduated beyond. So we're interested to talk to Ben about his book. So patreon.com/LeftReckoning, get that.
It's interesting. He's doing a book on Hitchens?
It is, yeah.
Boy, yeah, I took a journey with that dude.
Yeah.
Like his stuff on Kissinger, he was just like a hero.
He was nailing it with Kissinger, pretty good with the Clintons too.
And then
Mother Teresa, and he's generally good on Marxism early in the 80s, and then kind of, I don't know.
And then he really wanted to go to Iraq.
Yeah.
And
made some connections with some like
at one point,
type folks.
We were just saying, at one point the booze just becomes, the party starts to wrap up a little bit, and that booze doesn't get you drunk as much as it does get you insane. And by the early aughts, Hitch's he was pretty soft. He was pretty soaked. Let's put it that way.
Also, I just want to shout out.
Brain's not so malleable.
That was well documented. But.
And, yeah, he was always drunk. If you hear like stories of him and like pre-tapings of stuff, and he's always just soused. But I do want to also shout out Brian Kerr, who in the chat said, for what it's worth, Peacock is how he found the Majority Report. So,
is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm interested to hear. Yeah. Anybody who is in that same boat, sound off.
Oh, yeah. Please do. Because I got to be honest, I didn't think anybody like that existed.
It's the first I've heard.
Never, ever, ever got that sense. And now it makes me wonder, did we do the right thing by...
I was about to say.
It's like after a breakup, you find a little memento.
Exactly.
See like on Instagram, oh, they're really having a great time.
They're doing great. Yeah, wait a second.
Who's that in the background?
Wow, that's...
Take me back.
Hey guys, it's Sam. Listen, what like I notice, like you're just doing like a perspective, like you know, like MSA, like what do you? Okay. Anyways, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back, back. Back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
What?
Come on!
What?
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.